The Civil War, Chapter 2, Password B, Uniforms and Rifles. In both the Union and Confederacy, adequate outfitting of the recruits and seasoned troops, that is, issuing uniforms, weapons, and equipment, and replacing lost, worn out, or destroyed items, was essential. In general, the industrialized North had an easier job outfitting than did the rural South, where coping with shortages of everything became a way of life. Both sides, it was common practice for officers and men to add or to replace standard-issued uniforms, weapons, and other equipment at their own expense. Nonetheless, as do most armies, both Federal and Confederate armies specified regulation dress and gear with which all soldiers became familiar. Federal uniforms. Union and Confederate armies both issued a dress code, although not all soldiers and cavalry followed it. Federal infantry officers and men were issued a long dress coat of dark blue wool and a dark blue jacket known as a blouse, which they preferred to the dress coat. Additionally, they were given light blue pants, a dark wool shirt, socks and drawers, long underwear pants that protected the legs from chafing by the trousers when marching. Each infantryman also received rugged black shoes called gunboats by the soldiers. The most common hat was a kepi, a cap with a visor and a round, flat top that slopes forward. These were also called forage caps. Broad-brim hats were also worn. Union cavalry dress was much the same as for the infantry. However, the horse soldiers were issued shorter jackets, boots for instead of shoes, and pants that were reinforced in the seat and legs for riding. Artillery personnel wore the same uniform as the cavalry, since they rode horses alongside their guns on the march. Federal insignia. Officers fastened rank insignia to shoulder straps, while non-commissioned officers, that is, sergeants and corporals, sewed chevrons onto the sleeves. The buttons of enlisted men's uniforms were stamped with a spread eagle, while those of officers were marked I, C, or A for infantry, cavalry, or artillery, respectively. The uniform cap of officers and non-commissioned officers were embroidered with either a large blue bugle for infantry, yellow crossed sabers for cavalry, or red crossed cannons for artillery. Additionally, affixed to the front of the cap was a brass number indicating the wearer's regiment, seated above a letter indicating his company. On their caps, federal privates had brass buttons, bugles, sabers, or cannons, depending on their branch, along with the brass numbers and letters. Confederate dress. A Confederate infantry soldier was issued pants, a white cotton shirt, drawers, socks, shoes, and a kepi. The Southern uniform code originally called for a long gray coat, but it was soon replaced by a short gray jacket that reached only to the waist and which gave the name gray jackets to these troops. Regulations called for light blue trousers with a red stripe running down each leg of officer's uniform. In practice, officers and men alike ignored the regulations and wore gray pants. Cavalry and artillery regulation uniforms were much the same as those for the infantry, with modifications like those of the Union Army. The Confederates used the same color code as the Federals to indicate service branch, with a kepi's crown being so colored as to show the wearer's service. Buttons with A, C, or A, or I, standing for infantry, cavalry, and artillery, also identified the service branch of officers and men. Officers fastened their ranks insignia to the collar and to the sleeve, while non-commissioned officers, alike their northern counterparts, wore chevrons on the sleeves. Dressing to please. Union troops tended to follow the uniform code more closely than did Confederates. As one British observer noted after reviewing an Arkansas unit, The men were well clothed, though without any attempt at uniformity in their color or cut, but nearly all were dressed in gray or brown coats and hats. I was told that even if a regiment was clothed in proper uniform by the government, it would become partly party-colored again in a week, as the soldiers preferred wearing the homespun jackets and trousers made by their mothers and sisters. The generals were wisely allowed them to please themselves in this respect. Even the generals followed this informal uniform practice. Robert E. Lee almost always wore a civilian frock coat. Confederate cavalry units were particularly fond of non-regulation uniforms. They saw themselves as swashbuckling heroes, and Carter writes, in keeping with the dashing image, they created their own uniforms in every shade of blue and gray, with a penchant liking for gold and scarlet trim, braiding jackets, silk-lined capes, soft-brimmed hats, and hussars or high boots. The well-known cavalry commander General James E.B. Jeb Stuart favored a scarlet-lined jacket, yellow sash tied with gold tassels, elbow-length gloves, ostrich-plumed hat, and gold spurs. Union cavalry tended to be much less colorful than Confederate, although members of the 3rd New Jersey added extra braid to their jackets and wore hussar boots with a yellow-lined cape, for which finery they were called the Butterflies. Union cavalry General George Armstrong Custer rode to battle in a black velvet, gold-trimmed jacket and pants, a blue shirt with wide collar, upon which were silver stars, and a crimson scarf tied around his neck. More fancy dress. At the beginning of the war, neither side was consistent in its uniforms, and a variety of styles appeared during the first year of fighting. Militia units often wore their pre-war dress, and many volunteer regiments wore uniforms of their own design, assembled for them by wives, mothers, and sisters. Among Confederate troops, Irish volunteers from Mobile, Alabama, wore green. An infantry company in North Carolina favored red shirts and black pants, and a company from Tennessee was decked out in yellow, earning it the name of Yellow Jackets. Among the Union boys, a New York regiment known as the Highlanders wore plaid, and the Garibaldi Guard adopted red shirts, dark blue pants and coats, and a round, full-brimmed hat with a plume of black feathers. The most colorful of all non-regulation uniforms, however, was that worn by Zouave infantry regiments. The Zouave uniform was modeled on the dress of the French infantry serving in Algiers, the name Zouave taken from a people native to the mountains of that country. This uniform generally had a short blue jacket trimmed with gold lace, ribbon, and buttons, a blue shirt open and cut low cut, scarlet pantaloons, that is, baggy pants tied at the ankles, yellow leggings, and a blue sash, headgear, either a turban, a fez, or a tasseled cap or kepi, was always red. Both Federal and Confederates adopted Zouave uniforms, causing confusion on the battlefield. At the First Battle of Bull Run, Confederate General Jeb Stuart mistook a New York Zouave regiment for a friendly one from Louisiana before he discovered his mistake, and he and his command were fired on by the Federals. Similar confusion resulted from other uniform choices as well. Also at the First Battle of Bull Run, some Southern troops were wearing blue, and some Union forces gray, drawing friendly fire. A major disadvantage of Zouave and other colorful uniforms was that they stood out in battle, and thus their wearers became easy targets, leading to high casualties among many non-regulation units. For these reasons, the fancy uniforms were mostly discarded by the end of the first year of the conflict, although some Northern companies retained the Zouave costume until the end of the war. Password 2. The Springfield Rifle. After uniforms were issued, and sometime before, came weapons, of which the most important in the war was the infantry rifle. Both Confederate and Federal infantry units used many different types of rifles during the Civil War, but the most common was the Springfield, named for Springfield, Massachusetts, where most of the guns were manufactured. The Union Army made or bought some 1.5 million Springfields during the war. The South depended on stocks of rifles taken from Federal arsenals that were now in Confederate territory or captured during the battles and raids, but did produce some Springfields at the Confederate Armory in Richmond, Virginia. The Springfield was technically a rifled musket because its barrel was longer and thinner than a true rifle's. It weighed 9 pounds and measured 5 feet in length, over 6 feet with bayonet fixed. It fired a single shot, and it was accurate up to a quarter mile. At close range, anything under 1,000 feet, it was deadly, as this description by Confederate General John Gordon confirms. My unit's rifles flamed and roared in the Federals' faces. The effects was appalling and horrible. The entire front line went down in the blast. To load the Springfield, the soldier took it from a belt pouch, a cartridge, a paper-wrapped package holding gunpowder and bullet. He bit off the powder end and poured the powder down the barrel, then pushed in the bullet after the powder with a ramrod. Experienced soldiers could load and fire 3 times a minute. A nervous or exhausted soldier sometimes loaded his rifle incorrectly and put the gun out of action. He might put the bullet in and then the powder. He might jam several cartridges down the barrel. One rifle found at Gettysburg Battlefield had been loaded with 23 cartridges. Or he might simply forget and to take out the ramrod and shoot it away. After a battle, a soldier was expected to clean his rifle. He filled the barrel with warm water, plugged up the ends, and shook it to agitate the water. Next, a rag attached to the ramrod was run through the barrel. The soldier finished the job by scouring the exterior of the barrel and other metal fittings with abrasives such as ashes or emery. Cavalry carbines. The cavalry used a much lighter weapon, shorter-barreled rifle called a carbine. With their shortened barrels, carbines had an effective range of only 450 to 600 feet, sufficient, however, for the type of close-in fighting required by horse soldiers. Several types of carbines found use in the Civil War, but Union cavalry favored the Sharps and the Spencer. Unlike the Springfield, these guns were breech-loaders. That is, ammunition was fed into the barrel from the rear through the rifle's breech. In the Sharps, a soldier pushed the trigger forward, thereby removing a block and exposing the bore, or the rifled tunnel, in the barrel through which the bullet traveled. A linen-jacketed cartridge was slipped in place in the breech and closed. The Sharps fired 3 times more rapidly than the Springfield. The Spencer was a repeater and could fire 8 shots before having to be reloaded. The rate of fire was about 5 times that of the Springfield. Its metallic jacketed cartridges nestled in a tube in the rifle's shoulder stock and were fed into the firing chamber by a lever. The Spencer, which was some 3 feet in length, was a prized cavalry weapon and was also used by some infantry troops. Confederate cavalry appreciated the advantage of the Spencer, but could only use the repeaters as long as they had Federal ammunition, because Southern armories lacked the technology to manufacture the specialized Spencer cartridge. Most Confederate horse soldiers made do with a shortened muzzle-loading Springfield or other infantry rifle. They also used stolen Sharps or a Confederate imitation. Southern armories were able to supply the ammunition for this breech loader. Revolvers and swords. Various types of handguns were toted in the Civil War, but the favorite was the 6-shot Colt revolver. Colt manufactured 2 versions, a Navy issue and an Army model that took a larger cartridge. Both models were carried by Union and Confederate Army officers. Confederates using either stolen Federal arms or Southern copies. All members of the cavalry, North and South, wore pistols, although when issued breech-loading carbines, the horse soldiers found them more effective battlefield weapons. Federal and Confederate officers, as well as some sergeants and corporals, carried swords. Cavalry units were also issued a heavy curved type of sword known as a saber. Swords, indeed all cutting weapons, such as bayonets and knives, proved of little use in a Civil War battleground, where rifle and artillery power were the keys to victory. Even in hand-to-hand combat, notes Wiley's, soldiers much preferred grabbing the gun by the barrel and clubbing with the butt, but even 1% of the Civil War wounds were caused by swords, knives, or bayonets. Fully equipped. Along with guns, swords, and bayonets, soldiers and cavalry of both sides were issued a range of other gear. Large items including knapsacks and blankets, one wool, one rubber, to keep off the rain. Each soldier received a leather cartridge box fastened to a shoulder strap, and the divided tin interior of the box could hold 60 rounds. Canteens were issued, canvas-covered metal for Federals, wood for Confederates. Troops were also given a second shoulder bag, called a haversack, in which they carried food. Eating utensils, a plate, and a cup were hooked to the belt. A fully equipped and fully armed infantryman or cavalryman carried 40 to 50 pounds of regulation gear, including his weapon. Much of this weight and equipment was shed as troops gained experience, reducing the load to some 30 pounds, for as Confederate General Richard Ewell said, the road to glory cannot be followed with much baggage. Thus, a rolled blanket slung from the shoulder to waist instead of a knapsack and haversack easily carried personal effects and food. Cartridges were stuffed into the pockets. Some men even threw away their canteens, using their cups to drink out of streams and springs. Discarded also were extra clothing and coats, since most of the fighting took place in warm weather. Even the cavalry stripped down to make their load lighter on their horses for faster movement. In the end, as one Confederate observed, reduced to the minimum, the private soldier consisted of one man, one hat, one jacket, one shirt, one pair of pants, one pair of drawers, one pair of shoes, and one pair of socks. His baggage was one blanket. Cavalry needs. In addition to uniforms, weapons, and standard equipment, cavalry units needed both horses and horse tack, such as saddles and harnesses. At the beginning of the war, both Federal and Confederate war departments required that each cavalry trooper provide his own mount and tack. According to Starr, the U.S. government paid the owner 40 cents a day for the use of his horse, supplied the feed, and paid the appraised value of the animal if it was killed in battle, but not if it died of disease, starvation, or overwork. The Confederate government's policy was the same. Though a number of Northern regiments were raised under these terms, in general the policy failed in the North because many recruits lacked both a horse and the means to buy one. By August 1861, the Union War Department began supplying both mounts and riding equipment to cavalry units. The suitability of these horses, however, was dubious. One member of the 1st New York wrote that these mounts were of the very worst description, and not one of six of them fit for the cavalry service. They were of bad stock, many of them blemished beyond cure, and of an age that showed that they should have long since been sent to die in a different and less hazardous service. Many of these horses had evidently been nursed into tolerably good conditions externally, but they would show their defects and break down under the least hardship or exposure. By no means were all lots of horses this bad, and in general the Union system of supplying horses, as well as replacement mounts, worked to keep Northern troopers riding. The Confederates retained the old policy of trooper-provided mounts, and it hurt them during the last years of the war. The South had a smaller overall supply of horses than the North, and as horse casualties climb, a severe horse shortage plagued the region. Even when a cavalryman could find a horse, demand often priced it beyond his ability to buy. A cavalry trooper on foot soon found himself transferred to the infantry. Password 6. Shortages. Horses were not the only items in short supply during the Civil War, and although shortages affected the Southern Army far more than the Northern, both Union and Confederate troops suffered from them. Warfare is hard on both clothes and shoes. Shoes were among the most important possessions of both Union and Confederate infantry, but long marches to and from battles, particularly in rough country, quickly wore out even sturdy-issued footwear. Confederate soldiers had increasingly difficulty in getting new shoes as the conflict wore on, and Southern resources dwindled. Many found themselves barefoot, even in winter. Some made footwear out of green cowhide, which did not hold its shape well and began to rot soon after it was fashioned. Others found replacements by taking the shoes from dead Federals or Union prisoners. Indeed, many Confederates found it necessary to use bits and pieces of Federal uniforms to replace the rags of their worn-out clothing. Such seizure usually meant that the cloth had to be bleached white to remove the blue. Union blankets were also a prize sought by Confederates, many of whom were forced to use pieces of carpet to replace their own loss or threadbare blankets. It was a rare Confederate cavalry raid whose sole object was to strike a blow against Union troops. In general, Southern horse soldiers were always looking to steal Federal supplies. Replacing worn-out shoes and uniforms was sometimes difficult, even for a better-supplied Federal army. Both the Antietam and Gettysburg campaign left many Union soldiers shoeless. After Antietam, one Union soldier wrote that, "I saw men with no coats, no underclothes, in rags, and with no shoes." The causes of shortages. For the Federals, shortages were most common at the beginning of the war, when the war industries had not yet geared up to meet Army needs. Another source of shortage was the war profiteering. Cheap and inferior materials were sometimes used in the production of Federal uniforms and shoes by dishonest manufacturers seeking a fast buck. Such shoddy goods fell apart quickly, and supplies would thus be drained more rapidly than expected, leading to shortfalls. In the South, shortages rose in part because Confederate industry was too meager to meet Army demands, and partly as a result of the Union blockade that kept goods from reaching the South. Moreover, even when raw materials were available, labor was not. Thus, during the winter of 62, 2,000 Confederate soldiers were assigned to do nothing but make shoes. Women all over the Confederacy, including the wife and daughters of Robert E. Lee, made socks for Southern troops. Some women even managed to turn out whole uniforms. One result of these Southern shortfalls was a change in the color of Confederate uniforms from gray to yellowish-brown, known as butternut. After 1863, the blockade reduced supplies of the cadet grade dye needed to color Southern uniforms. Confederate cloth producers turned to a homemade dye from walnut shells and copperas, a substance produced by soaking rusty iron in water. Butternut-colored uniforms became more common than gray, particularly among enlisted personnel as the war dragged on. Uniforms and weapons were the trappings of the Northern and Southern soldiers' world, and indeed could not make soldiers of untrained men. As in all wars, during the Civil War, training and discipline were essential to turning hundreds of thousands of former civilians into soldiers and cavalrymen. Password 3.